Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data science, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Dan Keller. Dan is the Chief Data Officer for Capital One in the UK. Capital One are one of the biggest credit card issuers in the UK, and Dan's team are responsible for how data is collected, analysed, and turned into action. In his LinkedIn profile, Dan says, "I love data." Good start. There's nothing more exciting than using the information we have all around us to understand more about how people interact with the world through their financial products. And he goes on to say, "I'm also on the lookout for ambitious, talented people to join my team as we build out our capabilities, using data to change banking for good." So listen up, everyone. You even might want to connect with my guest today. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us as well. I should probably tell our listeners that we first met, I think, when I was chairing the Data Leaders Summit in Barcelona. 2 years running, Dan, I heard you present there. You were excellent both times. So I know that our listeners are in for a treat today.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So let's crack on with my first question. As you probably know, all the guests I've had on this podcast, I asked them initially to tell us a bit about their backstory, if you like, so listeners know where they're coming from, the context of their comments, advice, and experience. So let's continue that time-honored tradition. Dan, could you tell us a bit about your background and how you got into the world of data and statistics?
Absolutely. So I arrived into the world of data and statistics through mathematics. So I've had a lifelong passion for mathematics ever since kind of the beginning of school. And I guess where this really kind of took off was going to university. So I studied mathematics at the University of Nottingham and graduated in 2000 with a BSc. Mm-hmm. I stopped at that point and really wanted to look at opportunities to apply mathematics and statistics to real world problems at that point. And so was keen at that point to actually find a role that I could do that. And kind of a key point was being in the computer lab of the university, and I saw a flyer for Capital One, and they were looking to hire people who came from all kinds of different backgrounds, but a real focus on analytics and mathematics. So I applied, was successful, and I've been at Capital One ever since. So when I joined Capital One, had only been in the UK for about 3 years and was very much in kind of a rapid growth, fast-moving organisation. And so it was a great place as a new graduate to kind of cut your teeth and learn some of those skills.
Right.
My initial role was to look after the models that we were using in our direct mail marketing business. So the models that looked to predict whether people were likely to respond to direct mail, and if they were, whether we were likely to accept that application for credit. Over the next kind of 5 years, I worked on a variety of different models and analyses across the whole customer lifecycle, from marketing through new customer acquisition and onto kind of existing customer management.
Okay.
Also, operational use cases and even some people analytics as well as part of that. I then kind of stepped into a leadership role, so leading a small team and providing statistical support to various different test European businesses that we were running at the time, and slowly kind of grew my team as we looked to pick up more models, more analysis. I got kind of overall leadership for the UK statistical team in 2012, and became director of statistics, responsible for the team strategy, delivery of that strategy, recruitment and development. Mm-hmm. Also included a big kind of job family transition that we looked to make to move from being statisticians to data scientists. Okay. About 2 years ago, moved into the UK Chief Data Officer role. And so this role kind of encompasses data analytics, data stewardship, data science, analytic engineering, and data product. And so by bringing together all these aspects of data, we really benefited from being able to focus on what really matters and breaking down silos. So yeah, I love it.
Great, great. Now, thank you, Dan. Very, very eloquent and nice to hear someone who's got such a clear kind of trajectory through their career and kind of momentum of just doing more and enjoying it and making more of a difference. It was good to hear. I noticed that you chose to stop your academic study after your first degree because you wanted, as you said, to focus on practical applications, which makes sense. Given many data leaders, including a number who I've had on this podcast, make a point of their master's degree or their PhDs and the value they've got from that, I wondered if you'd ever regretted, and if not, make the case for the opposite, make the case for stopping after your first degree.
I don't actually regret it. I think at the time it really made sense for me to move away from academia and join Capital One and really kind of get my hands dirty with some real world data science. And that was kind of a great move for me personally. And kind of by that, I mean this kind of building an end-to-end application from problem through to in-market solution. That's the bit that really kind of excites me, really interests me, and has done since the early days. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not important to know the maths behind the approach that you're taking. And the analogy I always tend to use is that I think a great data scientist should have all the books on the shelf, ranging from kind of simple regression through complex neural networks. Mm-hmm. And the key is knowing when to reach for which book. Mm. Sometimes an arithmetic mean is good enough. So for me, kind of that's where that skill comes from. Mm. Being able to balance the complexity versus the operational risk, that takes a lot of judgment, I think. And that's where, as data scientists, I think we really kind of try and come into our own.
Yes.
So then I guess the question is, how do you build the knowledge to know which book to take from that shelf?
Yes, yes.
And I think there's a few approaches that personally I've looked to try and use. Firstly, actually, this is a team game. And so kind of hiring a team that has diverse backgrounds and experiences is just really useful. You know, as a hive mind, you're able to fill up that bookcase much quicker if you have people who know different techniques and have different experiences.
Yeah, it makes sense.
The second is actually to build and maintain really strong links to academia. So whether that's kind of providing master's projects, sponsoring PhDs, taking part in regular forums, guest lecturing. And that's a way that I've looked to really kind of stay plugged into the academic side. And actually, we're fortunate to have some really strong links with the University of Nottingham at Capital One. And we kind of regularly make sure that we're exchanging ideas. It's also really important to look beyond academia and into the wider data science community. And that's where kind of making sure that we are attending and presenting at conferences, reading lots of papers, aware of what's going on kind of outside the team. So that's kind of where I get my interest. That's where I get kind of the additional ideas, the innovation. The other part is making sure you've built in some time to experiment and invest in what the team might need in 10 years. I think it's very easy to potentially fall into the trap of working on whatever project is needed this week. And actually making sure that you've got some time set aside on, well, what might we be doing in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, and how do we do some kind of experiments? That's really important, I think, as well.
Yeah, makes good sense. Thank you, Dan. Actually, interestingly enough, just before you shared that, one of the things I was contemplating asking as a follow-up question to you sharing your initial career story, was that whole flyer or poster you saw in the computer lab from the University of Nottingham, and wondering whether, given that led you into a career you've clearly found very satisfying, whether you were building strong links ongoing with the university. And maybe I'll ask, how do you keep that mutually beneficial? And I ask that because I know I've kind of heard cases both where the relationship seems to be totally about simply providing some input to the university and it doesn't improve the employer's flow of talent in, but also the other way around, where the commercial organization is just trying to suck what it can get out of the university and doesn't necessarily really help the students develop. How do you make that a really strong long-term relationship with the University of Nottingham rather than a one-way street?
I think it has to be that kind of symbiotic relationship. I think going into it with a clear understanding that actually there are things that we as an employer need, but also we have a responsibility as an employer to make sure that the universities continue to work on the things that actually matter.
Yeah.
So I think part of this is you can't fix this with a quick kind of meeting. It has to be a long-term relationship that you look to try and build. And actually, you know, the links that we have to Nottingham University go back 20 years. Then I think it's also about being really upfront as to what matters and what doesn't matter. I think it's easy to fall into the trap of just doing a range of things without necessarily having a clear strategy on it. And so we've been very upfront with Nottingham. What they're really keen on is their students having some real world data science problems that they can practice on. And also to make sure that the things that they're teaching as part of their master's courses and so on are actually things that employees care about. So we can really help them with that. On our side, actually, it is there's two aspects. One is around helping us kind of fill out that bookcase. Yes. If there are particular techniques that we perhaps don't have time to fully explore, then it's a really good partnership if they can kind of look at those techniques and bring them back with some of the pros and cons. But then the other side is the talent side. And actually we've been incredibly successful by building these links that we continue to find really talented data scientists who come out of the university.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, Dan. I know when I've heard you present before as well, you've got a very clear talent recruitment and development strategy, maybe more of a focus on learning what works and how to get better at recruiting development of your people than I've heard from many a data leader. I was interested, actually, given that, do you choose to recruit some people who are master's or PhD level, or even encourage some of your existing people in the organization to go on to that study in parallel with their job? Or is it something that you see this symbiotic relationship with the university makes up for and they don't need the qualifications?
I think my general ethos is pretty much to try and help my team develop the career in the way that they want to. I don't think there's one path actually that everybody needs to take. And so we have had people in the team before who have left to go and do PhDs, for example. Mm-hmm. But equally, actually, if there are particular areas that they want to find out more about or develop their career in, then we try and do what we can to shape their role so that they get some experience of those aspects.
That makes sense. That kind of flexibility to, I wrote a blog post once on shape the role around the person, not the kind of role description. And I agree with you completely. The other thing I probably want to pull out at this stage from the career story you shared with us, thanks for that, Dan, is compared with most, but not all, there have been others like you, the guests on my podcast, you're unusual in having been so long with one employer. So I guess the obvious question to ask is, what's kept you at Capital One? What's so good about Capital One, Dan?
And you're not the first person to ask me that either. And it is something that I continue to to think about. And whenever I get asked that question, I think there's two aspects that are really key to me when I'm thinking about my career and the work that I do. One is to make sure that I continue to work on things that interest or excite me. And secondly, making sure that I'm surrounding myself with people I can learn from.
Yeah.
So on the work side, in particular, the thing that's been really interesting for me over the last 10 years in particular has been the evolution of data and analytics. It's a really good example of how the roles evolve in that you continue to work on things in different ways. One of the things I've always tried to say to myself is I never want to build the same model in the same way twice.
Right.
Because I think what that means is that there's no innovation there. There's nothing new coming in. There's no fresh ideas. And so if I think about some of the work we do at Capital One, one of the big applications of data science that we have is around credit risk and credit risk modeling. And historically, this has been an area where a regression model has been king.
Yes.
Regression has been king for many years. But actually, one of the things we've been able to look into and evolve over the last 10 years is bringing in some of those machine learning techniques, especially gradient boosting machines. What that's allowed us to do is, firstly, it kind of leads to more powerful models. So we're able to get more of those decisions right. But also, it's allowed us to speed up the cadence of which we kind of build and implement models.
Right.
And so that's been a really kind of fascinating area to learn about some of the foibles of GBMs and how you look to maintain them, build them, optimize them. And there's lots of other examples in my career of kind of areas that have evolved. It's interesting that you mentioned kind of shaping the organization around the people. Now the chief data officer role that I'm currently in is a great example of that. I kind of saw a real need to bring together the various different data professionals in the organization, was able to pitch it, why it was important, and to make it happen. And so kind of the evolution of my career at Capital One has almost meant that I haven't had to go elsewhere to try and find the next step. On the people side, I feel incredibly honored to lead a really talented and skilled team. We're up to about kind of 80 people in the department at the moment. And they come from a real variety of different backgrounds, different skills, different experiences. And that all kind of comes together in a really great way. And what particularly has kind of stood out for me, especially over the last couple of years, is just the amount of care that there is for each other that's displayed. Kind of definitely see that even from the kind of early days of the pandemic and working from home and trying to work out exactly what we were doing. There was a lot of care for making sure that everybody in the team was okay and was able to get on with their work and balance all the other things that were going on at that time. So like I guess to wrap it up a bit, so a previous mentor told me it's really good practice to apply for roles elsewhere every 12 to 18 months. It kind of stops you becoming stale. It gives you a good view of your options, allows you to continue to assess what matters. That's something I kind of live by and definitely look elsewhere on a reasonably regular basis, but haven't been able to find a role that offers me those two aspects around the work and the people in the same way.
Nice answer, Dan. Thank you. Interesting insight into that. And I can understand how that must help you with the retention of your talent as well, given that almost every survey that you see of data scientists and analytics professionals high up on the list of what they're looking for is being able to make a difference, being able to continue to develop and grow, and well-being, a support, a kind of a positive culture that they want to be part of, not just salary, which people often focus on. So I wonder, have you seen the fruits of your labours in that sense? Are other people who work for you staying longer, or is it just you and they're turning over on the average kind of 2-3 year tenure and onto another job?
So I think we do see some of that benefit. We continue to see relatively low attrition and actually quite a high degree of engagement within the team. I think there are there are always opportunities elsewhere. And this is something I kind of continue to say to my team is, you're not beholden to a particular organization. I think it's really important that you know what you want to develop your career and to get to the lifestyle and the life that you want. And when people leave, generally I feel good that they're leaving for the right reasons. So they're leaving because there's a really great opportunity to develop their skills elsewhere, or they're looking to make a step in a different direction. And so I think generally we do see elements of that. What I'm really keen on is making sure that we continue to invest in that. I think it would be easy to take the foot off the gas at that point. And whereas it's something you have to continue to work at, you have to continue to listen to people's concerns or what they want to do next and continue to evolve the way that the team's structured.
Yes. What wise counsel, Dan. It is easy to become complacent, and I've seen organizations who are great take a dive because of that, because you just think, oh, we're great at the people management side, and it isn't a once and done. I completely agree. Okay, another thing to bring out maybe is, and it's cropped up a few times in things you've shared, the frequent use of the word statistics. You've spent much of your time at Capital One focused on statistical work following your first degree. And you've obviously had roles right up to director that actually had statistics in the title. So I'll be interested. I wonder what your take is on the growing dominance of the label data science to include statistics and everything else. Do you see it as beneficial and having added to your capability? Or do you think it's a distraction from what is often still mainly actually really applied statistics work?
So I think it continues to feel a really exciting time in data, whether you label yourself a statistician, data scientist, machine learning, AI expert. And I think we're really starting to see the talks about benefits coming through. When you look at these things, a lot of it is underpinned by the scientific method that's at the core of statistics. And so one of the things I'm very keen on is that we don't move away from that routine and process that actually is embedded in statistical theory. So if I think about things like overfit is a great example of actually where statistics and statistical testing give you the tools and the techniques to guard against some of the things that can really bite you. However, the large-scale computing required now means that data engineering skills can no longer, in my mind, be seen as an add-on, but they've got to be vital to your team. Right. And I think that's where this big transition has happened over the last 10 years. I think I will freely admit when I was kind of a practicing statistician building models in my early career, my software engineering, data engineering skills were pretty amateur. And I don't think the level of coding that I had was great, to be honest, and actually what would be needed now. And so, you know, actually for me, it's about bringing together all these different skills. And, you know, you don't have to look far to see examples of long, long lists of here's the million skills that a data scientist needs to have.
Yes.
And, you know, if I'm honest, if one person has all of those, firstly, good luck finding them. And secondly, if you do, you definitely can't afford to hire them.
No.
And so for me, it's all about building the best team. You need to make sure in your team you're playing to specialities, but that everybody has a really good understanding and respect for each other's skill set and speciality, so that no one set of skills is enough. So I disagree. I don't think it is mainly still applied statistics work. I actually think that you need to have both those aspects at least to get to a great outcome now.
Fair pushback, Dan. Thank you for that. Interestingly, do you still have any roles that are labeled statistician, or is every statistician wanting to be called a data scientist these days?
Formally, we have data scientists. Now, I think this depends on the individual. You know, we have certain members of the team who are way more focused on the statistical theory And again, we can kind of shape their role. Actually, we've got plenty of statistical work that plays to their strengths, as opposed to potentially people who've come to us from more of a computer science background who actually are great at things like pipeline development and testing and coding efficiency. So like it's a broad church.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how you mentioned the kind of, as we've all seen them on social media, et cetera, the sort of enormous lists of the superhuman data scientists with a million skills. How much have you got into the explosion of job titles as well? So I suppose I'm thinking of things like having someone who's a data visualizer, having a data ops team as well as data engineering, or having a specific machine learning model engineer and a deployment engineer. Have you got lots and lots of these titles, or do you take an approach like you just described with data scientist, where it might be one fairly generic job title and it flexes depending on the person?
So the latter there. We have a relatively broad data science definition, but then we'll shape that to the individuals. It's an interesting question, and it's something that myself and my leadership team have spent quite a bit of time on over the last couple of months. So across data, we may only have a few kind of job families, but actually we probably have maybe a dozen different roles that maybe have different skills or different focuses, and actually getting really sharp on what's the difference between those roles is really important. It makes it easier for people to understand what their responsibilities are. It makes it easier for them potentially to move roles. And so actually kind of the more you think about it and the more you're able to lay those differences down, the easier I think it is for people to understand.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree, Dan. Glad to hear you're doing that work and that thinking. I think clarity and career paths, et cetera, are very important for development of people. The other thing I noticed, and I think you called out explicitly at one point, was this whole thing that you've worked, if you like, right across the customer lifecycle. I think you were talking at one point about the different models that have been built. I wonder whether you felt that having worked on such a range of different business problems, possibly helped by having been there so long, has that helped your work in increasingly influencing the business strategy? Does it cause you or your team to have a greater commercial understanding, so you can actually be the authors of more change in the business rather than just serving what's required of you?
I think that's our responsibility, to be honest. I think a successful chief data officer needs to sit across business strategy, consumer need, and data expertise. I think there's a risk that if you're too focused on the data and the algorithms, it means that you potentially build a range of models that are not used, either because it didn't meet the real business need or you didn't really understand the constraints. And I've got loads of examples of that in my early career. There was a model I was looking to build on acquisition risk, so credit risk detection for loans. And at the start of the project, we had, I think, about four different potential uses for this model. And I just kind of went away for 9 months, worked on the model. And in the meantime, kind of each of those four use cases kind of evolved or fell by the wayside. And so I got to the end of the 9 months and I had a perfectly adequate model, but no real use case. And that's not great. It feels demotivating and it doesn't feel the best use of your time and skills either. And so kind of having that focus on the business need, I think, is really important. But equally, As a CDO, you also need to have the credibility in the data space to be able to set the strategy and hold a high bar for the products that have been delivered. And so I think a key part of my role is to try and help unstick projects and provide some clarity by spanning data and business. The third aspect that I mentioned is really understanding the consumer needs. And I think as a chief data officer, I think you do have a role in trying to shape that. And so a particular example that I'm very excited about over the last 12, 18 months is a role I've been playing as part of the FCA and Bank of England's Artificial Intelligence Forum. And so that's really kind of helping to shape how AI can be used in financial services and managed responsibly. And so that's all around kind of understanding the consumer response to AI applications and how, as an industry, we want to address that and almost kind of get ahead of some of those questions in the way that we manage and govern AI.
That's great. Thank you, Dan. Yeah, I was really struck by, I was glad to hear it, the three emphases that you brought out there. You often hear CDOs or senior data leaders recognize their need to translate between technical and the business and have both the commercial understanding and the technical understanding. But someone who also has got very much a customer insight kind of background, you don't always hear that customer champion or CCO type thinking in hat as well. And I think you're right, the trio is very powerful. I wonder, from your experience of things like that FCA and Bank of England initiative, would you encourage other data leaders to get involved in public initiatives like that, which are seeking to either regulate or create a better outcome for your customers that isn't primarily led by commercial objective, but led by the best interests of the customer or consumer?
Definitely. I think you end up with a better outcome all round the more that data professionals are involved in the discussion and the shaping of where these things go. I think actually kind of in particularly that forum has been a really interesting forum to be part of. It's allowed me to kind of meet people from all parts of the industry and to build some really strong links and good understanding of different perspectives. I would definitely recommend that.
Great. Good to hear. Another tip for all the listeners. Thank you. When you described your CDO role and your creation of it in some ways by the sound of it, it sounded like you brought together all the functions, your diverse kind of data management, data engineering, analytics, data science teams together. Obviously, that was a deliberate strategy. By the sound of it, you sort of pitched for that unity. I wonder what you found to be the benefits of such a complete function, because although I'm a fan and took a similar approach, I do sometimes hear from leaders who either face a lot of political barriers to getting there, or are concerned that they're seen to build an ivory tower or center of excellence that's a bit removed from being close to what the business is doing. So what's the benefits and how have you avoided the pitfalls of that approach, Dan?
Yes, yeah, loads of benefits. And I think part of the benefits is leaning into what potentially could be the pitfalls.
Okay.
You mentioned the ivory tower approach. That's something I'm very, very aware of as we were building the department. And so for me, the first benefit had to be around kind of what is the business benefit for bringing together the data professionals into one group. Mm-hmm. And what we've found is that we're able to provide much more focus and a better product because the team is working together rather than each step in the chain just solely optimizing their part. Mm-hmm. So for example, if the data scientists are working much more closely with the data product team, then it means that the platforms that they're using are more appropriate. Yeah. If they are working more closely to the data analysts who are going to play a key role in the monitoring of what happens or the implementation, then again, you're less likely for things to fall through the cracks or for misunderstanding to happen. It's also allowed us to prioritize at a departmental level what we're working on. So rather than creating individual silos for each of those different data functions, we're able to say, well, what actually matters most to the business and work on that. So business benefit, definitely kind of number one. The second is kind of a real opportunity to share ideas. So having one department means you've got the focus on the scale to do things differently. A good example of this is around recruitment. So we are looking to find lots of data professionals across lots of different data families. Yeah. But actually there are some similarities in our process there potentially wasn't any similarities in our process. So being able to bring that together, standardize some elements of it, saves time, makes things easier. And it also allows us to try some different things. So one of the initiatives I'm most proud of over the last year is the opening up of data secondments and data roles to people who potentially work in our operation. These might be people who haven't come through the traditional route and maybe haven't been to university or have that kind of data background. What they do have is a really great understanding of our processes and the consumer. And so by having one department where we can have one strategy on this, we've been able to create these kind of initiatives that bring people into the team with different perspectives, different ideas. And that's been just really exciting to see how that's worked. We've had four people move into the department and just do amazingly well and bring some great ideas and skills. And we just wouldn't have been able to make that work if it was kind of separate teams. Talked a bit about greater flexibility, but definitely there are times where one area has been under pressure, and by being just one department, we've been able to redirect people and not prioritize in silos. And then I think it also brings a bit more transparency between what roles mean, making it easier for people to rotate or learn new skills. So generally kind of loads of real benefits. I think continue to be aware of the potential pitfalls and to put more of my time and effort into making sure they don't happen. But so far, so good.
Okay. Yeah, no, well done, Dan. And you sound very eyes wide open about the whole activity. So that sounds great. Interesting. And it seems such a tie up with your own perspective on academic qualifications, the way that you've got this opportunity for people without a data background or even perhaps without a degree to come into the function. I wonder, are those people then, who, as you rightly mentioned, have maybe great process and customer knowledge, are they just learning on the job, or have you got some kind of internal data academy, data university, whatever language you use, for people to potentially learn the skills and knowledge that they need internally rather than need the degree? What's your development route for those kind of people?
So predominantly learning on the job. I think that we do have in place some of the more technical learning. So coding, for example, is a big requirement as part of the role. And so we want to make sure that we provide people with some learning paths that allow them to get up to speed. But actually, I'm a big fan of kind of the best way to learn things is to actually be doing something that matters. So kind of building these roles that allow people to slowly build up their skills by actually delivering monitoring or building campaigns or building models, I think is the best way to pick up some of those skills.
Fair enough. Thank you, Dan. The other thing that struck me, and I suppose this is probably full disclosure coming from mistakes I've made in the past, is another thing that can be tricky when you bring together these diverse functions is, frankly, some are sexier roles, some are more esteemed than others in the normal culture of data and analytics. I guess the typical would be people be a bit deferential toward the wonderful data scientists with their clever skills, and maybe not listen enough to the data management type people that are seen a bit as doing the grunt work, to use that awful phrase. I wonder how you've ensured an equality of people being heard and a valuing of the less sexy but absolutely essential functions in there.
Yeah, that's really important. And it was top of my mind as well as I stepped into this role. Having come myself from a data science background, I wanted to make sure that this wasn't seen as a data science takeover. Because you're right, some of those roles are just essential. You can't do effective data science if you're working on rubbish data. If I think about some of the more kind of direct impacting to the business things, they tend to be driven by really great data analytics underneath. So whether that's kind of the monitoring that runs and helps us understand what's going on, whether it's kind of building campaigns and managing strategies, and so that's really important to me. It is making sure that there's no kind of hierarchy within the department. We need to make sure that everybody feels like they have they get recognition for the great results they bring, and also that they feel like they have ways in which they can develop their career, both kind of with breadth, but also allowing for kind of moves up as well.
Yeah, makes sense. And I think you're absolutely right to keep an eye on that. Dan, I could speak to you all day. There's so many interesting topics I'm tempted to follow up on, but I'm aware of our listeners and the kind of implied promise of how long these episodes will be. So let me come to my final question, and it's one I've almost always used, because I find that it firstly gives a wide variety of answers, which is fun, but it's also hopefully a reminder that even as successful data leaders as yourself are still growing and learning and changing. So, Dan, can you give us an example of something you've changed your mind on in the last few years?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask me this. And actually, I had a good think about it. And I think there's two things that really have landed with me over the last 2 years, especially as we've gone through kind of the pandemic response. The first one is around that balance between short-term and long-term investment in the foundations.
Okay.
And I think one thing that's really clear over the last 2 years is the areas, well, maybe kind of the businesses, but also within our department, the areas that perhaps haven't had that investment in the foundations are the ones that really show at times of stress. If you've got really great process management, if your risk management is great and in a good spot, then actually you're able to react and pivot very easily. And so you can see it all across different businesses. Everybody who's been under stress over the last couple of years, but the ones who've succeeded had that really strong, decisive leadership and flexible systems and processes. So I think that's something that's really kind of strengthened in my mind over the last couple of years. The other area is really around hybrid working and how to use that in a way that leads to efficiency and engagement with your team. And I think the key to that for me has been to adapt my diary to the type of work that I'm doing. One thing I found early on during the kind of pandemic response was I was kind of spending my entire day on Zoom and finishing the day absolutely shattered because of all the context switching that was happening as part of the day. And so I kind of took some time out to really think about what are the different categories of things that I do during the day. So whether that's kind of the run the engine type meetings to just get decisions and move things forward, whether that's working with individuals in my team on their personal development, whether that is the time I'm spending with external organizations. So I think I ended up with about 8 different categories. And I did a bit of an audit as to how I was spending my time, and also looked at what percentage of my time did I think I should be spending on each of these categories. And it was pretty staggering that there were some categories of things that I just wasn't committing anywhere near enough time. And so what I tried to do then is kind of structure my diary a bit better so that I know that particular days I might be in the office. And actually, these are the types of things that being in the office and work and talking to people face to face are really helpful with. And so I'm going to make sure my diary for those days is focused on those types of meetings. Whereas when I'm working from home, there are things where I really benefit from kind of being able to get my head down and focus and work through that. And so by kind of structuring my week in that way, it's really helped. So I think kind of this period has also been a reminder that the changes in the world will find their way into data and models. And so that's got to be on your mind if you're obsessed about customer impacting models and analysis as well.
Brilliant. Thank you, Dan. A clear example of a leader who's constantly thinking and learning and changing and developing. So that's great. And delighted to hear the one example, because I do what's labelled as wheel of work analysis sometimes with my mentoring clients. And almost always people have a bit of a, oh, good grief. Yeah, now I really look at it. I'm not spending the time in the areas that I value most, and I need to take more intentional control of my diary to get that kind of focus. So good man, Dan. I'm glad to hear that. So, Dan, that has been great. Thank you. I knew it would be useful to talk to you, and thank you for everything you've shared with us today.
Not a problem. It's been great to be on.
Brilliant, Dan. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up, and each week there's also fresh content on our blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, it just remains for me to say Thanks everyone again for your time today. Have a great week and perhaps reflect yourself on either how you can get closer to your business or how you can develop your people more through those kind of links with the university or the benefits of bringing your function together. Bye for now.